The church in the early Middle Ages, we move now from the Imperial State Church to the church in the early Middle Ages, AD 605 to 1122. These are the dates we're using. Let me give you, a preliminary summary of this whole period. This is the, in the broadest possible terms, this is what goes on. Western Europe enters a dark age, as it has been called, with the disintegration of Roman civilization. We've seen this going on, and we've talked about it many times. Secondly, this period sees the emergence of the outline of a new culture, that is, the Christendom that we're going to be looking at, of the later Middle Ages. Very important to our studies, the Eastern and Western wings of the church drift apart. We'll talk about that today. And last of all, the first thing we're going to talk about is the period sees the rise and spread of the Muslim Revolution. This is of particular interest to us today because of the modern Islamic revival. Remember the Iran hostages and the war that's going on, the revival of Islam. We look at the East, first of all, the East. And you know what I mean now by the East. First, the Goths break into the Balkans and weaken the Eastern Empire. One of the reasons the Muslims took over the East, or almost all the East, was that they had been weakened by dissension within the church, but also by the Goths, the northern Germanic barbaric tribes had broken in. And secondly, the revived Persian Empire, the Sassanids they're called, we have the Parthians, the Persians are called the Parthians in the days of Jesus in the first period. And they pretty well died out of the Persian Empire. They enjoyed a revival, the Sassanids, and this threatened the eastern borders. Are you with me geographically? Do you know where we're talking? Let's use this map. Use this map here. These are the eastern borders of the empire. The Eastern Empire, the Sassanids, revived, that's what they're called, it's a dynastic name, sort of revived Persian Empire. The Goths break in this way, they come down, and they weaken the empire. But come down both around the, you can see around the Black Sea. Okay, now, We look now at the Muslim conquest. I use the term Muslim as opposed to Muslim. I think Muslim is more correct. Mohammed is quite a character. I wish we had more time to talk about this, but Mohammed was a young village boy who was extremely idealistic. And you recall all the disputes that are going on concerning the deity of Christ and the relationship between that and monotheism. Well, he reacted against Trinitarian theology. You know, the cry of the Muslims is what? Allah is one. There's one God, Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. There's only one God. Well, this came as a reaction to this Trinitarian theology, where, as the Jews said, and as the Muslims say, the Christians have two or three gods. And he created a simple, moral, deterministic monotheism. I will simply say this, and you I hope will sometimes study into the Muslim faith. Muslim faith is has many good things going for it as faiths go, as far as being practical. In my opinion, the primary reason why there's two aspects of the Muslim faith which makes it a powerful faith. Not true, but powerful. One is it's exceedingly simple. Now, one of the reasons that it's not working today in Iran, or many reasons it's not working, but one of the reasons is that it is too simple for a modern world. Things are just not as simple as they used to be. It is generally conceived by scholars that one of the reasons why Muhammad did what he did was that the Muhammad came from the Arabian Peninsula down here, the desert, which was a tribal area, and that the traditional tribal society was being threatened by at least two things. One, by the fragmenting influence of Christianity, as it was expressed in that time, as they knew it. Remember, we talk about all the divisions of Christological controversies, all the problems they were having. This was causing trouble. Secondly, there was on the edges of this tribal society, there was an increase in commercialism. And one of the things that Muhammad seemed to want to do is to preserve the stern tribal simplicity, the old way of life, which was simple, and direct. The second thing, aspect of which made it very powerful, is that it was deterministic. Whatever happens must be the will of Allah. So it's as deterministic as Calvinism, even more deterministic. If Allah wills it, it will happen. And whatever happens is Allah's will. Extremely deterministic. As I said before, I noted myself, in modern Islam is in trouble for many reasons, one of which is that it's just too simple to fit into a modern, international, cosmopolitan kind of world. It just doesn't, in other words, it works very well for a tribe, it doesn't work as well. Now, do not misunderstand me. The Muslims built great cities, very advanced civilizations, but they were extremely simple compared to anything we would think about. That is simple. For instance, their justice is very simple. You steal something, you cut off your hand. Capital punishment, you break certain laws, they take you before a one-man judge, and he may, and in some cases, you have something of a jury, you know, some judges, and they decide whether you're innocent or guilty. They decide you're guilty, they take you out and shoot you. And that's the end of that. Exceedingly swift, they have local tribal judges, like the Ayatollahs, for instance, are very powerful men. You pay him a fee, here's your trial, he says this is it, and that's it. Well, that's quite simple. In 613, Muhammad began to have visions. In 622, he made his famous Hijra, or Hijara, as it's sometimes called. He was forced to flee from Mecca to Medina, and the Muslims mark this as the beginning of the rise of the movement, this famous journey from Mecca to Medina. In 630, he had a vision which caused him to resort to force to impose religion. That is, from this point on, you evangelize with the sword. Their theme was kill the idolaters. And fanatic Arabs began to sweep over the Eastern world. These were tribal peoples. They were exceedingly sturdy, very simple society, very fierce. And the urban societies of the East were very corrupt. We've seen that already, haven't we? Remember the advice by Jerome that to stay away from the clergymen who use perfume. We recall how Chrysostom lashed out against the softness and the luxuriant living of the people in the cities. They were simply soft. Well, you get a soft society. It's the same thing we had with the barbaric tribes coming down from the north. They were tough. In 632, on the overhead, you have the basic movements in this early period. It's not a very good projection. In 632, the Arabian Peninsula passed into the hands of Muhammad and his followers. On your syllabus, you see that black thin area? Where's the Arabian Peninsula? As we trace it, this is just going through it with seven league boots. In 635, yes? Before. In 635, you had the capture of Damascus. You can see on the maps I put in your syllabus how it spreads. 638, the conquest of Jerusalem. And by the way, Jerusalem was in the hands of the Muslims, with the exception of the time of the Crusades. Jerusalem was temporary. Parts of it were temporarily in the hands of the Crusaders, but except for that, it was in the hands of the Muslims until modern times. 641, the conquest of Antioch and Alexandria. And we could take time to trace that down. By 655, the Muslim Arabs had occupied Egypt and North Africa. By looking at the map, you can see they're really moving. In 732, after the Muslim forces had taken Spain, they were turned back at Tours in France by Charles Martel. And look what's happened. Why Europe is very much afraid of the Muslims. They have taken the areas of the most advanced civilization. This is where our civilization was old and deep and wealthy. Recall our discussion of that. And if the strongest part of the empire could not stand against them, what would the West do? But Charles Martel, the Franks, turned them back at Tours in 732, very famous date. They stopped the northern incursion of the Muslims. But you see, if they had not stopped them, Europe was in the middle of a pincer action, getting from both sides, coming up this way, coming up this way. Now, not only did Charles Martel, this Frankish prince, was able to turn them back. It was a military victory. But to give you a balanced perspective of it, the Muslims were a long way from home. Their supply lines were extended, and it was cold. It was kind of like the French going into Russia in some ways. That is, the logistics of the situation, the distance and everything else, the problem of supplying the armies, defeated the Muslims as much as the armies of Charles Martel. But be that as it may, they were turned back, and they can occupy Spain for many years. And the Muslims are very much a force in the medieval world. They're there. If you don't believe it, read, for instance, Don Quixote. Don't bother reading book two. It's not worth reading, but read book one anyway. Read Don Quixote. You see the model. It's just very much a part of European life. The force of Islam was blunted by dynastic squabbles. Quite interesting. In the early years, one of the reasons that they were able to win out over the Christian areas was that the Christians were so badly divided, and the Muslims were very united, this very simplistic religion, simple religion, and they taught much of this. They were very proud of this. They argued this way. Well, one of the proofs that God is with us, that we're the truth and you're not, that Allah is the true God and Jesus is just one of the prophets, Jesus is not God, our unity. The problem is that when they got expanded and by 732, they themselves were divided. Dynastic squabbles. You see, if you study this, you'll see that the power lies in the hands of the descendants of Muhammad. They got in a real odd squabbling. Who were the descendants of Muhammad and who weren't? And who had authority and who didn't have? Leo the Isaurian, emperor of Constantinople, one of the leftovers of the Byzantine Empire, what's left of it, not very much of it was left. He successfully defended the city 716, 717, did it by the way, by setting the Muslim boats on fire, using what was called Greek fire. Nobody knows what it was, but some kind of chemical warfare. They simply set the Muslim navy on fire. And so for a long time, Constantinople was an island of Christianity in a sea on the edge of a Muslim sea. That is, Now there were many, we're going to talk about this later, but there, but the, it was a, you have just across the straits here, just across the water from Europe, you have Constantinople, which became the jumping off place for the Crusades, we're going to see later on, because the whole land of what was formerly called Asia Minor was now Muslim. But the city, which was a fortress city, remained in Christian hands. It did not fall, by the way, until 1453. It's not fall 700 years later. It's a long time. Think about it. But, and this, and for about 300 years, the Eastern Empire, you could study this, there was a renewal of sorts. They reclaimed some of the land, at least temporarily, such as southern Italy. Some of the Mediterranean islands were recovered from the Arabs. That is, the Arab surge was stopped by Charles Martel in Tours. It was stopped by the successful defense of Constantinople by Leo the Isaurian, and it fell back. It surged and fell back a little bit. The Christians regained some of the territory, but not very much. And so it was sort of a Mexican standoff. Yes. Yeah, well, he was a Christian Greek, you know, Christian leader of Christian emperor of Constantinople. I saw it was his family name. He would be Greek. It would be Asian. You know, they were all the ancestors of modern Turks. In 1025, the Seljuk Turks, one of the branches of the Muslim peoples, began a new area of conquest into Europe, and toward the end of our period, toward the end of 1122, the Seljuk Turks moved later on up in this area, and this was one of the occasions of the Crusades that sparked the Crusades, which we're going to discuss later. After the Seljuk Turks were turned back by the Crusaders, the Ottoman Turks emerged, and in 1453 took Constantinople, posing a new threat to Europe. So there was a later resurge of the Muslims. I give you the dates here, and I wish I could spend more time on that, but this is these are the main dates. This is you had the early surge. They were turned back by Charles Martel and by Leo the Isaurian. The pincer movement was stopped. For a long time, the Muslims sort of fermented and became very much a part of life. In the Mediterranean world, up into Europe, they were there for a long time. They occupied Spain for a long time. Well, the Gibraltar is named after the Muslims, and it's a Muslim designation. And then later on, several hundred years later, there was a resurgence, the Seljuk Turks, and the Ottoman Turks. And Constantinople fell. This new surge helped to spark the Crusades. Well, a footnote to the Muslims. The Muslims are often, they say their theology was very simple, but they were not simple. They were not ignorant barbarians. I think you ought to know that during the Dark Ages, the Muslim society was intellectually far advanced of Christendom. I think you ought to know that, for instance, our modern math and chemistry comes almost directly from the Muslims. You say the word algebra, it's a Muslim word. Muslim scholar, although, of course, you know, our number system came from the Phoenicians, we know that, but there are much of it, but what I'm saying is that in its modern version, you do realize that the modern science of chemistry is based upon Muslim scholarship. So, do not simply think that they are just, you know, a lot of barbarians. Well, so much for that. I wish you can read more on if you're interested. But what, as far as Christianity is concerned, what happened in the East, for the most part, is that a weakened church, a weakened Christian society, what there was of a Christian society, could not withstand the vigor of the Muslims. Look at the church in the East. What was the policy of the Muslims toward the Christians? Well, the Muslims regarded the Christians as people of the book, and they were not subject to death as idolaters. Not generally so. Some cases, in some extreme situations, Christians were put to death. But overall, and this is quite complex, but simply to say, overall, the Christians, while they were restrained, they were suppressed, they were not put out of business. We're going to see later when the Crusaders come in, they run into strong Christian communities, but they can't tell them from the Muslims, but they wear Eastern robes, it's interesting that the Christian communities that the Muslims allowed to survive for centuries, allowed to function and left them alone for centuries, many of these Christian communities were clean or destroyed by the Crusaders. They didn't know who they were. So the church has not been universally, was not always destroyed. In fact, there was an overall sanction. Christianity was weakened to the point of near extinction in the Muslim domains, however, principally because the church had been weakened by the theological controversies we've been studying, and because it was no longer able to educate a leadership. As to where they were suppressed, they were restricted. It was not business as usual. Much like it is in, for instance, Russia tried to use this same policy to get rid of the church, technically speaking. That is, to let the older people go ahead and believe what they want to believe, but no education. You cannot educate a leadership for the church. And so it was because of these factors that the church suffered near extinction, not because they were lined up and put to death as idolaters. That was not true. Once in a while, but that was not the overall policy. Y'all see that? We next look at the church in the East. We see that the emperor is now the head of the church. It's called Caesaropapism. The more extreme integration of church and state even than we find in the West. We've already mentioned that. There was very little theological controversy or progress. There was very little theological vigor or life. First of all, the church, as I indicated here, was afraid of further theological discussion. They saw what had happened. It weakened them. The liturgy was fixed and reflected their theology. That is, you know anything about liturgy? On a certain day, the certain prayers that were said, what went on when the church gathered. And since the church reflected theology, you couldn't change theology without changing the liturgy. And so it became more or less fixed. The church in the East had come to pride itself on its orthodoxy, especially vis-a-vis the West. And so it meant holding on to the old ways, the thought of the past, and this concept that we are the Orthodoxers. By the way, the Eastern Church came to call itself the Orthodox Church, and it's called that today. But the Orthodox Church, you mean the Church of the East, the Eastern Orthodox Church. Well, this attitude, they came to call themselves that and to think of themselves that way. And this very attitude, of course, discourages speculation and change, and so there has been very little change since. There were some limited theological issues. Monothelitism, we've already discussed, continued to be an issue in this period. I'm not going to discuss that again. I put it here for the sake of completeness. There emerged a group called the Paulicians. People often ask, are there not people down, you know, where were true believers? Were there any true believers in this period? Well, here you see the kind of people who wanted to have something of a restoration movement. The Paulicians, they claim to be followers of Paul. They came from an area south of Armenia, and here. They were Persian dualists, basically, but they rejected the Catholic hierarchy, and they rejected most of the expressions of lower Christianity. You know what I mean by lower Christianity now, don't you? Worship of relics, the worship of objects less than God, they rejected that. They were persecuted in Europe and fled to Muslim territory. Their thought continued for centuries in a group called the Bogomils, and you can look them up if you're interested in pursuing that. Look that up in an encyclopedia sometime. But the Paulicians or the Bogomils, they survived for several centuries. Still, you can still find traces of them today. So they're important in that they show that everybody wasn't sitting still for this, for the extreme corruptions of Christianity that we've seen in our discussion of lower Christianity. Then there was the famous iconoclastic controversy. If you know anything about the Church in this period, you probably would know this, that the emperors of the Isaurian dynasty, remember Leo the Isaurian, his family name, in Constantinople, his empire's gone, he's still got a city left, very little land, a little territory, he sought to outlaw the use of images in the worship of the Church. This is again, as in the case of the Paulicians, now this represents a reaction against lower Christianity, against this invading superstition. Now, icons, you know what the word icon means, don't you? It's synonymous with image, and it's the Greek word for image or statue. The icons had been one of the great talking points of the Muslims against Christianity. They would point to, they say, what was their battle cry? Death to the idolaters. Well, you can see how easy it was for them to point to the use of images in worship and say, aha, you see that? By the way, it's much the same thing. We point to the use of images in the Roman Catholic Church of the West, and we say that's idolatry, and they say, no, it isn't. But you see how easy it is for us to say that it is, because there they are. You see people paying homage to them, venerating them, you see? And so Leo thought it'd be a good idea if the Church removed this stumbling block. And that was the only reason he did this, but he opposed this, the use of icons or images. But do you see how the Muslim pressure would be upon him? For more than 100 years, the controversy raged in the empire. Should you use images or not? Icons or not? The great iconoclastic. What's an iconoclast, by the way? Iconoclast means to tear down an image. You'll see it today, somebody who goes against tradition, who goes against old accepted ideas, he's called an iconoclast, a metaphorical use of this. And so there were those who wanted to tear them down, tear them from the churches. The common piety of the people, as I indicate, was tied to the images, and the emperor simply could not displace it. That is, it was a superstitious age, it was an ignorant age, it was a dark age in the East as well as the West, although not as dark in the East. The Muslims had messed everything up, and the common people, the common Christians who in these, especially in this Muslim-dominated territory, had a little opportunity to learn. Their religion was fixed. It was a lower kind of Christianity, as we know, and it was simply too ingrained in the people for him to get out. There were too many people who for too long a time had been using the images.
Was it more of a disagreement with the fact that the dream of the lower Christianity than the Christianity as a whole?
Well, all of former, except for the Paulicians and some small groups like that, Christianity as a whole was lower Christianity. It contained it. You couldn't separate the two. Well, the image worshippers, those who were in favor of the icons, ultimately won with the aid of the famous theologian in the East, John of Damascus. Speaking on behalf of the common people, this is the kind of thing, and I thought you'd be interested in this, so I put it in the syllabus. This is the defense that John of Damascus used for the images. And he's speaking on behalf of the common people. He says, I am too poor to possess books. I have no leisure for reading. Well, anything to read, and wouldn't have time to read it if I could. He didn't say I can't read, which was true of many of them. I enter the church choked with the cares of the world. The glowing colors attract my sight and delight my eyes like a flowering meadow, and the glory of God steals imperceptibly into my soul. I gaze on the fortitude of the martyr. See, there's the image of the picture, usually in this case, of the saint, this martyred saint. I gaze on the fortitude, see, the courage of the martyr, and the crown with which he is rewarded, and the fire of holy emulation kindles within me. What's emulation mean? No. What do you do if you emulate something?
Copy it,
right. You imitate his. In other words, I have that same kind of courage. His courage causes me to have courage. And I fall down and worship God through the martyr, and I receive salvation. So that's the kind of defense he offered. Well, Irene, who was the queen regent for her son, he was too young to rule, put herself on the side of the people, mainly for political purposes, by the way, and reversed her stand. You see, her predecessor, Leo, he had, the princes of the Isaurian dynasty in general, the descendants of Leo, and Leo and his sons, they had opposed the images. She comes in and she takes the other side. And by the way, that's why she's called Saint Irene. She's a saint that the Greek Orthodox Church has, that the Roman Catholic Church in the West doesn't have, Saint Irene. She was the queen regent who voted, who came down in favor of the icons. Well, the Seventh Ecumenical Council, see, the church is still united, Council of Nicaea, 787, dealt with the matter of images. And here we have the decree. We therefore, following the royal pathway of and the divinely inspired authority of our holy fathers and the traditions of the Catholic Church, for as we all know, the Holy Spirit indwells her. That's quite an interesting point. Define with all certitude and accuracy that just as the figure of the precious and life-giving cross, so also the venerable and holy images. Note that they're equal to the cross. As well in painting and mosaics as of other fit materials should be set forth in the holy churches of God, on the sacred vessels, on the vestments, on the hangings and the picture, and in pictures, both in houses and by the wayside, to wit the figure of the Lord, of our Lord God and Savior Jesus Christ, and of our spotless Lady, the Mother of God, Theotokos, and the honorable angels, of all saints, and of all pious people. For by so much more frequently as they are seen in artistic representation, and by so much more readily are men lifted up to the memory of their prototypes, and to a longing after them, and to these should be given due salutation and honorable reverence, not indeed that true worship of faith, latria, which pertains alone to divine nature, you recall our discussion of that, but to these as to the figure of the precious and life-giving cross, and to the book of the Gospels, and to other holy objects, incense and lights may be offered according to ancient pious custom. For the honor which is paid to the image passes on to that which the image represents. See, you worship the image, you're automatically worshiping God. We have discussed that. And he who reveres the image reveres in it the subject represented. For thus the teaching of our holy fathers, that this is the tradition of the Catholic Church, which from one end of the earth to the other hath received the gospel, and it is strengthened. And by the way, this was accepted in both the East and the West, except for one point of difference that I point out here. In the East, there was a compromise because there was never much objection to it in the West. But because of this objection, in the East, they still use images, but only two-dimensional images. There's no difference in their view of images or icons, except that in the West, statues, three-dimensional images are required. In the East, a compromise because of this controversy, this pressure, this objection. And only two-dimensional pictures are used. They function the same otherwise. Did you know that, by the way? You will find images, that is only pictures, murals, stained glass representations in the Eastern Orthodox Church, whereas in the Roman Catholic Church, you can have a statue. Now, what they decided in the East was that if it's two-dimensional, it is a proper image. If it is three-dimensional, it might be an idol. But there was no difference. That statement simply says we can use the images, we can use the icons. But in the East, they determined to use only two-dimensional ones, and still do today. Well, apparently made a difference to them. The veneration paid to it is no different. Just the definition of what an icon can be. In the West, they can use a statue. In the East, they say, no, it's an idol if it's three-dimensional. If it's two-dimensional, it's a proper icon. Well, John of Damascus, who's quite an interesting character, we don't have time to look at him too much, but he has been called the John Calvin or Thomas Aquinas of the Eastern Church. He's the one who really, if you look at a theologian who fixed, listen to me, a theologian who fixed Eastern Orthodoxy in the same sense that Augustine fixed Western Orthodoxy, you would look at John of Damascus, although John of Damascus simply repeated much of what Augustine had said. But John of Damascus is the great theologian of the East. He set forth, as I say here, a systematic synthesis of what had already been defined in the East, and thus fixed theology and orthodoxy for the indefinite future. The last thing we talk about is the separation of the eastern and western branches of the church. We're going to go through this very quickly. First of all, list minor factors in the separation. There was a difference in language, Latin versus Greek. We're talking about the church now, not society. There was a difference in culture. Byzantine high culture and wealth, that is, in the areas that the Muslims had not conquered, the modified barbarianism of the West. The East thought the barbarians were a bunch of, the people in the East still thought the people in the West were a bunch of hillbillies. And the people in the East thought the people in the West were a bunch of snobs. Yes?
At this time, Constantinople was taken over by the Muslims?
No, not till 14. See, we're in the period, our period ends in 1122. It fell in 1453. Good question. No, it's still in, quote, Christian hands. There was a difference in political control. The barbarians in the West did not recognize the authority of Constantinople. For a long time, the most powerful man in the West had been whom? The Bishop of Rome. And here's this man over, and the bishop, the technical, the official head of the Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, the Emperor of Constantinople, would be called that Constantine had moved the empire to the East. He claimed authority in the West, but he could do very little to enforce it. In fact, he was barely holding out against the Muslims. And so people in the West simply ignored him. Here's the problem. Here's a different culture, different language now. Who cares what he thinks? Those are minor factors. Major factors, there was the growing claims of the Bishop of Rome alienated the church in the East. Just as in the, as far as the empire was concerned, the people in the West said that the emperor in Constantinople is a figurehead. But when it came to the church, it was the other way around. The Bishop of Rome was claiming universal authority. And I've already said it never was recognized in the East, certainly wasn't now. The Bishop of Rome, the head of the bishop over the whole church, chief bishop, head apostle. In the East, they told him to go jump in the lake. The points of the controversy, by the way, the growing claims of the Bishop of Rome was the major factor in the separation of the church. The points of controversy, first of all, the iconoclastic controversy. I've already talked about that. These Isaurian restrictions on three-dimensional objects. The Isaurians said that, in other words, Constantinople sent out the word only two-dimensional objects, and the people in the West said no. We'll use three-dimensional objects. There was the famous Filioque controversy. Filioque is Latin, means "and the son." And look back in your addendum 2, turn back to that now. The creeds, see the Nicene Creed, on the first page of addendum 2? Like I had this footnote at the bottom, these words are omitted by the Orthodox Church. You can look at that and see exactly, in the Nicene Creed, we know what the Nicene Creed is, the Bishop of Rome arbitrarily added the word filioque so that this sentence reads, "And I believe in the Holy Ghost, the Lord, the giver of life, who proceeded from the Father and the Son." Now, he just arbitrarily put that in. Now, both East and West recognize the Nicene Council as an ecumenical council, still do. It is divine revelation. And the issue was, here's the Bishop of Rome claiming all this authority. The Christians in the East saying he doesn't have it. Now, are you with me now? Here, the issue was not so much that they disagreed with this statement in "and the Son." They didn't care so much about that. What got them was the unilateral action of the Bishop of Rome. Who does he think he is amending the Council of Nicaea, or amending the Nicene Creed? See, it's one thing to say that the Ecumenical Council at Nicaea has the right to make an authoritative statement, but something else to say that the Bishop of Rome has the right to stick in an amendment. So they did not object to what he wrote so much as the fact that he presumed to do it. Now, there was some theological ramifications. That is, in the East, they emphasized the distinctions. They accepted the Tertullian formula, one God, and one substantium, three personae. But in the West, the unity of the Trinity was emphasized. In the East, the distinctions of the personae were emphasized. Not a difference in content, a difference in emphasis. And you can see, if you think about it, this addition of the word and the Son emphasizes the unity of the Godhead. The omission of it emphasizes the distinction. Now, you can just trace that down. You'll see what I'm saying? That you can review this. When you add, say, and the Son emphasizes unity. If you leave it out, it seems to emphasize distinction of the three personae. So it was an issue. There was a definite theological issue. But the major issue, the main objection was the presumption of the Bishop of Rome to change, to amend, to the creed, to add to the creed of Nicaea. Y'all see that? So there's a primary, that was the primary objection, was political mainly. The second was secondary, was theological, and it emphasized unity vis-a-vis distinction. Did you all get my discussion on that? Okay, you can review that. And so this broke out into an open controversy between Nicholas I, Bishop of Rome, and Photius, Bishop of Constantinople. They had trouble. The situation was that Ignatius, who was the Bishop of Constantinople, that was the office, by the way, that John Chrysostom had held and then lost when he was exiled, very important office. A fellow, Bardas, who was a nephew of the emperor, came to communion, came to church drunk. And Ignatius would not allow him to have the Lord's Supper. Well, the emperor didn't want his nephew insulted that way. It's a very corrupt government, and he simply deposed Ignatius, who was the Bishop of Constantinople, and put Photius in his place. He says, "Okay, you even though my nephew was drunk, you got no right to do that, to keep him from the Lord's table." So he fired him, which he didn't have the right to do, and replaced him with Photius. Well, he did have the right to do it technically. This is Caesaropapism. He's the head of the church, but there were supposed to be procedures followed, which he didn't follow. Ignatius, who had lost his job, he thought he was right because he should not have drunk to the Lord's table. He appealed to Nicholas in Rome. And Nicholas formally sent a decree back. He restored Ignatius to his job and anathematized all who would oppose him, including the emperor. What does anathematize mean?
Send to hell.
In other words, if you don't obey this, you go to hell. See, because the bishop of Rome controls the grace of God through the sacraments. Ignatius, this didn't help Ignatius a bit. It just made the church in the East mad. And that is, the church in the East, they didn't particularly like Photius, again. They weren't particularly against Ignatius. In fact, many of them saw the justice of this action, that Ignatius should not have been deposed. He was right. But again, they got mad because who does Nicholas think he is telling us we have to do something? Who put him in charge of the church? Keep in mind, in the East, they never did recognize the authority of the Bishop of Rome over the East. Well, that caused trouble. The final break came in 1054, and here was the controversy. The occasion was, and it's quite, you can read this, Leo IX, who is now Bishop of Rome, and Michael Cerularius, Bishop of Constantinople. What had happened was that, remember I said that that some of this land was retaken by the Christians? Well, there was some area in Sicily was taken back from the Muslims. Some churches, Christian communities were liberated. But these Sicilian churches down in Sicily had formerly belonged to the East. They belonged to the Bishop of Constantinople. They were part of the Eastern system. Well, what happened was that these Westerners had liberated, and they said, since we liberated them, they now belong to Rome. And so Leo took the position, as I say, that since the Westerners had liberated them, they belonged to the Western Church. Michael Cerularius retaliated by closing some of the churches in his domains, which used the Latin rite. There were people in his area who liked the Latin ritual rather than the Eastern ritual, small groups. So he closed them down. In other words, you take my churches, I'll close down yours. Well, that's not important, except to say that here's another point of controversy between the Bishop of Constantinople and the Bishop of Rome. What happened? Well, Cellularius and Leo exchanged charges of heresy on various points. First of all, the first step was, you tell me, the controversy started, the fight started over, see, the division was already there. The immediate fight started over who owned these churches and these liberated churches in Sicily. It started off, first of all, Cellularius and Leo exchanged charges of heresy. In July of 1054, papal legates, official representatives of the Pope, so a legate means, from Leo, publicly excommunicated Cellularius, the Bishop of Constantinople, in his own church. Wow. Can you imagine how that went over in the East? They didn't like the Romans anyway. Here are these Romans, these Latins, come over from the East, these legates of the Bishop of Rome, who claimed all this authority that they never had recognized, goes right into Cellularius' own church, the Cathedral of Constantinople.